Hi. Welcome to our panel, Queer Viral Practices in New Media Art and Theory, the wettest panel at South by Southwest. The artists here today for this panel, myself, Micah Cardenas, Zach Blass, right here, and Pinar Yoldas, all engage the viral and the biological more broadly through a set of methodologies that are best described as queer media art, indicating new directions for both queer theory and new media art. From my own collaboration with Elie Mermand that considers how viral rhetoric has been used to control populations and asks how DIY medicine may be able to respond to the hegemony of Western medicine, to Zach Blass's use of viral replication to defeat biometric recognition systems, pointing to new possibilities for political engagements that use the viral as a starting point, to Pinar Yoldas' explorations of speculative biologies which radically exceed heteronormative conceptions of bodies and bring the logic of biology into question. I'm going to go ahead and say the bios before each person talks instead of doing them all now so we can hurry up and get started. So I'm Micah Cardenas. I'm an artist theorist who works in performance, wearable electronics, hacktivism, and critical gender studies. I'm a PhD student in media arts and practice at University of Southern California and a member of Electronic Disturbance Theater 2.0. Put on your N95 mask and latex gloves for your protection and the protection of others. You walk into a room with a table full of instruments covered in dust, very old instruments from the 2030s, some broken into shards of glass and others burnt. Your study of ancient methods of viral performance art has brought you here to this laboratory in which new ways out of the religious dogma of Western rational science were rediscovered and reinvented. Amidst the collapse of information capitalism, before the myth of rigid national borders was finally eradicated in an instant by the H3N91 mutations, artists experimented with their bodies, applying a do-it-yourself and do-it-together ethos to medical science to imagine what might lie beyond all they knew. The sound of your breath is loud inside the mask. It's unclear what viruses were found here or not. As you approach a piece of paper on the table half buried under an iridescent dust, the faulty nanoscale photon networks flicker into motion, forming most of an image of an encoded memory, metatext hovering translucently at an angle above the paper describing the scene. She's testing me now. My heartbeats are spread open across the screens. The graph jumps up and down with my breath as she moves her instrument up and down my body, connecting the conductive thread, the low pitch droning, modulating over the repeating sound of our recorded voices, testing for viral contamination. I breathe more heavily, in and out in a circle through my cock, my stomach, my heart, neck, and third eye, activating my body for her, preparing for the next phase of testing. Lying on the operating table, I manage to slip open her zipper to reveal her nipple. I know that she knows, but she stays firm in her mission. We must learn about our bodies to escape the control of those who claim to know better than we do. Still holding her grip firm, she leans over to move her instrument over a far part of my body, teasing me with her nipple just above my mouth. She lubes me up, placing her electronic gloved hand on my eager ass. Once she thinks I'm ready, she slips it in me, and the looped voices change their pitch instantly as my heart rate jumps. The heart rate variability comparison data fluctuates wildly across the color spectrum. The voices multiply, the bass reverberates. All I can do is pound my head against the table, grab the edges, and breathe, my mouth quivering through the breathy moan. Again, the scene spins. You feel the tingle above the straps, holding your mask on, and you're back in the lab. Confused, you're breathing deep now, and with your heart beating loudly in your ears, you walk around to the other side of the table with the instruments. An e-reader presents... Okay, that's a little too dark. Speaking of e-readers, an e-reader presents a three... The lights are fine. An e-reader presents a three-dimensional image of two women facing each other, black masks on, one woman's hand wrapped around the other's neck, a colorful avatar writhing in the background. We are creating femme disturbance. Our corsets, thigh-high stockings, metal sex toys, and finely crafted glass dildos are not necessarily for capitalist production and feminized immaterial labor, and their presence disturbs the rational drive of the work ethic that demands that we sacrifice our desires during a time of crisis. Our desire for each other's femme bodies is in excess of the rhetorics of medical control. Our desire to see each other naked exceeds the laws preventing us from doing so. Our queer femme expression disturbs the rigid masculinist structures of science, medicine, and capital. Together, we're engaging in femme science to develop new modes of knowledge outside of the limited strictures of corporate-driven medicine, using our desires and cheap handmade electronics to create our own medicine, to learn about our bodies outside the bounds of our hetero-patriarchal world. Using biometric monitors, instead of quantification and distance observation, we create a deeper intimacy with each other, moments of interdependence and intersubjectivity. We've inherited a world with thousands of years of science and thought shaped primarily by men. Where queer and femme knowledge has been viciously stamped out by Western medicine, and yet the very time and space we inhabit are not the same as theirs. So now we will create our own worlds of knowledge with our bodies. Femme here is an affect more than an emotion. It's a combination of sensations and desires that drives us. We're inspired by Lisa Dugan and Kathleen McHugh's call for a femme science that is addressed to the future, a future where femininity as we know it, normal, egoless, tolerant of, and therefore complicit with deception, will have been completely superseded. We are pulling these future realities into our own and letting the resulting disturbances to the laws of physics multiply and proliferate. Our fashion will tear apart the established order. Our orgasms will burn down their buildings. Literally and figuratively, we reappropriate the objects of clothing which are thought to make up femininity, buying them from sex shops and then deconstructing them, cutting them open, rewiring them with our own conductive thread and sensors to create new queer modes of sexual connection and expression. We buy panties, bras, thigh highs, and choke collars and turn them into new DIY sex toys. An ultrasonic rangefinder bra, a pressure-sensing choking collar, a touch-sensitive dress, and a motion-sensitive glove that controls a strap-on vibrator. By reconstructing the meaning of science, medicine, femme, love, and community, we can survive in a world of biopolitical power out of control, a world that tries to kill us every day. The voices stop. By now, you're so disturbed that you run towards the door to escape the myriad of possible infections in this space. Suddenly, you're stopped by text hovering inside the door, seeming to block your way for a movement. Virus Circus follows the viral as a transversal line of inquiry that intersects with the militarization of medical authority, microscopic transnational migrations, and global economic inequality. Consisting of an episodic series of performances using wearable electronics, soft sensors, and live audio to bridge virtual and physical spaces, the performances explore queer futures of latex sexuality and DIY medicine amidst the speculative world of virus hysteria. The history of queer politics shows that the rhetoric of viruses such as HIV has been used to control marginalized populations, while viruses such as H1N1 reproduce these structures of power. You run out and find your body. Okay. So that text I just read is from my new book, The Trans Real, which was edited by Zach Blass right here. And the book has texts from and about performances. It's like theory, fiction, poetry, source code. It's a whole mix of things describing a number of performance projects I've done in the last few years. And so the book makes this claim about artists' strategies dealing with multiple realities, based in part on this statement from Karl Rove, who said in 2004, "We are an empire now, and when we act, we create our own reality. While you're studying that reality judiciously, as you will, we'll act again, creating other new realities. We're history's actors, and you, all of you, will be left to just study what we do." So Karl Rove said that to Ron Suskind in 2004 in the New York Times Magazine. And it kind of led me to thinking about political strategies and political effectiveness, because at the time I was spending pretty much all my time trying to get arrested to stop the war. And I found his statement really illuminating in terms of ways we might evaluate different political strategies. And I think that now we can see that multiple realities are kind of proliferating, from augmented reality advertisements from BMW to alternate reality games like World Without Oil, which was funded by the World Bank. And maybe they're proliferating in ways we might not like. So I developed this idea of trans-real, building on the notion of trans from transgender, about crossing gender boundaries. I propose that trans-real aesthetics cross the boundaries created by a proliferation of realities that occurred as a result of postmodern theory and emerging technologies. So this builds on theorists like Jack Halberstam, who claim there's such a thing as queer time and queer space that's separate and distinct from straight time and straight space. And so basically my claim in the book is that an understanding of building and working with multiple realities is important for artists and political actors today. So I propose three methods of using multiple realities. One is explicitly attempting to create realities, explicit reality construction. The other is transreal performativity or transreal identities. And the last is transreal technologies, imagining new logics. So today I'm just going to talk for a minute about transrealities and explicit reality construction. So I think a good, very strong and well-known example of this is Blast Theory. It's an artist group that creates alternate reality games in which they kind of focus on immersing the viewer in what they describe as a narrative and affective emotional kind of immersion. And so have people heard of Blast Theory? Who's heard of Blast Theory? Raise your hand. Okay, nice. Who's heard of alternate reality games? Raise your hand. Okay. Maybe Blast Theory is not as well known as I thought. I should correct that. So they did this project called Ulrika and Iman Compliant at the 53rd Venice Biennale in 2009. And so in this project, participants, when they start the game or the alternate reality experience, art piece, game, whatever, they're given a cell phone by Blast Theory, and they proceed to receive phone calls on this cell phone with instructions that direct them through the city of Venice. And at the beginning of the game, they choose one of two characters. They choose either Ulrika Meinhof or Iman Collins. And so these are two well-known leftist militants. So Ulrika Meinhof was part of the Red Army faction, or the Bader-Meinhof group in Germany, and so was involved in lots of blowing up cops and trying to stop the war with militant means. And so in the game, you choose to be either Ulrika or Iman and receive instructions like, pick up this package here from this person, take it to this place. And it's kind of, they present it as a kind of ethical dilemma that you participate in. So in my own work, the project that's most done this kind of explicit reality construction, or tried to do it in different ways, is Virus Circus, which, as I said earlier, is this series of speculative science fiction performances that took place in lots of different ways, including public space interventions, performances in galleries, and performances online. So the public space interventions we did were, this is one of them, we took the official CDC Cover Your Cough poster, which during H1N1 were very widespread and common. Has anybody seen this poster before? Okay, lots of people have. Good. And so we took these posters and we made a few different versions of our own. And we also made the performances based on kind of the imagery and rhetoric in this poster. And a lot of the posters, even after they were modified, stayed up for like a year at our university or around town, because it was so normalized to people that they didn't even notice that you might say, cover your cough, you may be asked to wear a mask. Failure to comply will result in a minimum of 10 years in a federal penitentiary. Apparently that was a perfectly normalized rhetoric for a lot of people. So in this series, Virus Circus, which the piece that I just read was part of a written piece that was about some of the performances in the series. Throughout it, we created wearable electronics devices to kind of help this feeling along of live of viewers experiencing a kind of live science fiction scenario, but also to actually like explore these ideas in the that I described, like fem science and DIY medicine, and to consider how we could, you know, what we could learn by making our own sex toys, and how we could consider how technology is extending bodies and transforming gender and sexuality. So for this performance at the Museum of Contemporary Art, we made this ultrasonic rangefinder bra and pressure sensing choking collar. And the collar was made out of just conductive thread and fabric and neoprene. And then for later work in the series, we made this touch sensitive dress with conductive thread and a thrust detecting glove that was attached to a strap-on vibrator, which was used in the penetration part of the performance. And we also wore these high-resolution electrocardiograms so that we could display the RR interval, or the time between heartbeats, which is like the number of milliseconds between heartbeats, has been shown to that upon analysis, you can see with the time, by knowing the RR interval between heartbeats, you can know more than just the heart rate about a person's body. Like you can know what parts of their nervous system are in use or how fast they're breathing or things like that. So that was part of that performance. And I think I'm just about out of time. So the last part of the series that we did was, was called Virus Circus Laboratory. That was at a gallery in Los Angeles called Los Angeles Contemporary Exhibitions. It was part of this exhibition called Speculative that Zach and Pinar were also in. And so for that last chapter, we kind of made an augmented reality installation where we displayed props that had been used in the performances, like the dildos and the wearable electronics, on this table to create a kind of imaginary computational interface. And so viewers, when they walked in, they would see the table with the instruments on it. But if you stood behind this pedestal, you could see the table with Ellie and I standing on either side masturbating. So the idea was that it's a computational, imaginary computational interface that requires lube and ejaculate fluid to work. To kind of question some of the assumptions about computing, why do we assume that computing should be this boring thing that you do at a keyboard? Why don't we need orgasms to make our computers work? So this is a close-up of that installation and that bra that I described. Oh. And in 3 seconds. So after the series, I've been working on a new project called Local Autonomy Networks that uses mesh networked femme fashions to create networks of safety for queer people and women and trans people to be able to communicate with each other and in a time of need and like have some sense of the direction of the other person, and working on movement performances based on the ideas of the Invisible Committee who urge us to find each other. Okay. Thank you. Not questions now. That's not true. So, now we'll hear from Zach Blass. Zach Blass is a Los Angeles-based artist and theorist working at the intersections of networked media, queerness, and the political. He's a PhD candidate in the graduate program in Literature, Information Science, and Information Studies, Visual Studies, Women's Studies at Duke University. He's also the creator of the art group Queer Technologies, a founding member of the public school Durham, and a contributing editor for the online journal Version. Zach holds a Master of Fine Art from University of California, Los Angeles, a post-baccalaureate certificate in Art and Technology Studies from the School of the Art Institute of Chicago.
Okay, hi everyone. So I'm Zach, and I'm going to be talking to you today about a project that I've actually just kind of started. So I'm going to be showing you more work in progress at a very early state. But I think it'll be exciting. I hope. At least it's exciting for me to talk about new work. So I've been doing this project called Queer Technologies for the past several years, and I'll just kind of show you some of that to get an idea of the work that I've been doing. So basically, Queer Technologies is this art group, and we kind of function as an art group, a political activist group, and we also kind of model ourselves as a company. And basically, we design critical products, and we try and circulate these in a variety of situations, like art galleries, or we shop drop them into stores. But just to kind of give you an idea, one project that we made was called Transcoder, which was this queer programming language software development kit. And the idea was try to imagine, since queer community has always been based on developing codes as a way to form sociality, what would it be like to update this into something like a programming language? How would that work? What would it make? And so basically, we developed a software development kit so people could take fragments of this uncompleted project and do work with it. And Micah has written a code poem with it for Electronic Disturbance Theater. Okay, another project is Engendering Gender Changers, which was basically exploring how plugs in a lot of countries, including the United States, are gendered male or female based on pinhole configuration. So we designed a whole other set of plugs, and at this point they were like old school serial adapters from Radio Shack, and we played with pinhole configuration to get, you know, a whole different set, and it would be something like the power bottom plug, which would just be this kind of like hollow interior. And so we also wrote this tech manual called Gay Bombs, which was actually about, it's broadly about the militarization of homosexuality, and focusing on the fact that in the mid-90s, the U.S. Air Force developed, or they had written a proposal for an aphrodisiac chemical that would be used against enemy combatants, and it would turn enemy combatants homosexual. So the idea of this logic is that this bomb that the military was developing was based around shame, that they would detonate it onto enemy combatants. These enemy combatants would suddenly become gay for each other, and they would be so ashamed that this was happening in front of people who they were fighting against, they would just surrender. So we were really interested in these militarizations of homosexuality, turning homosexuality into a weapon for the nation state, making homosexuality complicit with nationalism. And we basically kind of wrote this funny kind of manifesto tech manual that's basically explaining how to build and use gay bombs. And this is a demonstration of me showing you how to build and use a gay bomb. So today, though, I'm going to talk about this project that I'm doing with faces and biometrics. And Basically, this is kind of loosely connected to the idea of the viral. My work in the past was, I talked about this idea of a viral aesthetics, and it was the idea that the queer technologies work that you saw, it was all about maintaining this kind of parasitic relationship to capitalist production. So, you know, that's why they look like products, and they're very, you know, mimetically related to the actual technologies that we were kind of modulating off of. So there could be that, clear connection between the subversion of the actual product. And we were really invested in conceptualizing this as viral because of the history of viral within queerness. But today, I'm trying to think more loosely about the viral around identity. As the viral is something that's constantly mutating and changing, and has been theorized recently in new media theory as something which never stays the same, which kind of flies in the face of a lot of contemporary technologies that are all about standardizing identification processes, such as biometrics. So, right, biometrics, in particular, biometric facial recognition, right, it claims that it can determine identity by reading the surface of the body. And what's interesting about this work around the face from a theoretical and philosophical standpoint is that in philosophy, the face has always been this prized site of ethics for a very long time. If you think back to the work of Emmanuel Levinas and even contemporary work by the queer theorist Judith Butler, the face is always the site where we where the call to ethics, you know, comes to us. And Kelly Gates, a communications theorist, has written this amazing full-length study on biometric facial recognition called, Our Biometric Future. And she really explores how, because biometrics are being developed by various governing bodies, that they're completely reconfiguring what it means, what identity actually even means, and how it's constructed. So, right, how does this all relate to queerness? Well, a recent study came out from Tufts University that I'll just play this video and then continue.
To the terrain of sexual orientation, the Journal of Experimental Social Psychology recently published a 2008 study conducted at Tufts University that tested people's ability to identify homosexual men from photos of their faces. 90 faces were shown to 90 participants against a white background. The faces were stripped of all markings and accessories, such as piercings and eyeglasses. Even hair was cropped, leaving participants with only the face. Those tested proved remarkably accurate in their ability to recognize faces that had been classified as homosexual, even when exposed to the face for only 50 milliseconds, which is not possible to process consciously. Even when a section of the face was shown, such as an eye or lips, participants still correctly identified the homosexual faces.
Okay, so... So basically, this study illuminates a much older cultural claim that many people who are LGBTIQ have experienced, which would be this claim of fag face or gay face. And this is typically a form of harassment where, right, someone thinks that you're gay based on the structure, the literal biological structure of your face. And these are images from a Google image search that I did a while ago on fag face. And as you can tell, the main characteristic here is this normalized feminization of the face. And it doesn't even necessarily mean that these people are, right, gay or straight identified. It's more about feminized features. So this study at Tufts University basically scientifically validates this older form of cultural harassment against LGBTIQ populations. So basically, I wanted to investigate this and play around with it. So I made a parody video first of gay facial recognition.
Beginning homosexual facial detection database scan. Determining. Totally gay. Determining. Big fag.
Okay, so you get the point. What biometrics presents to queerness is that it might want to unintuitively become invested in forms of non-recognition, right? You would think about various minoritized politics in the past, and they've been all about gaining visibility. But these developments around biometric facial recognition and queerness and sexual orientation presents a case where a queer politics might be invested in trying to evade these forms of recognition by becoming unrecognizable. And I just wanted to point out specifically contemporary queer digital media artists that are actually exploring these forms of the unrecognizable as opposed to maybe more standard queer mimetic subversion like my earlier queer technologies work. And so here you have Jaime Del Val at the top, who's a Spanish artist, and he has this whole concept of devisualizing the body. And then Mike has done work around becoming dragon by turning into an animal. Okay, so, but really importantly, this study around biometrics actually points to the fact that there are... many contemporary radical political gestures today centering around becoming imperceptible, becoming unrecognizable. And so right here you have Anonymous, who right has been all about being non-recognizable. But you also have the Invisible Committee, who Mike mentioned earlier, which has been described by the French government as an ultra-left terrorist group, and their book, The Coming Insurrection, has been called a manual for terrorism. They have called for faceless actions and using anonymity as an offensive political operation. You have the artist Sean Dockery writing the Facebook Suicide Manifesto, which is all about overloading your profile with junk by being able to and by doing that, you kind of exist in this anonymous way because no one actually knows who your real friends are or what you actually like because you like and friend everyone. And then you have queer theorist Jack Halberstam theorizing about queer darkness and becoming unreadable, becoming unlegible. You have Alex Galloway, who's a media theorist, talking about how the political protest tactic, the black bloc, which is popular in Europe, emerging coterminously with the black box, so linking the rise of black box technologies with black bloc tactics. And you also, okay, so basically, right, there's all this stuff swarming around today around becoming unrecognizable and imperceptible. And so what is the response to this? Well, the other radical French group, Ticoun, has said that basically they diagnose the situation as cybernetic capitalism. And they say it's technologies, intense interlinking with capitalism that is actually producing these types of political responses about trying to become unrecognizable, imperceptible. Okay, so basically, right, this is even in philosophy. I just put this up there since our panel also has theory in the title. So this is by two French post-structuralist philosophers from the 60s, Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari in A Thousand Plateaus. And right, they theorize that if human beings have a destiny, it's actually to escape the face. And what they mean by that is to actually escape all forms of recognition and identification itself. And then you have an information scientist like Phil Agra, right, who wrote in the early 2000s that your face is not a barcode. So this is all kind of pervasive and coming from many different angles, but it all kind of coheres around technological identification standardizations. So basically, I decided to do this project around facial weaponization, and basically the way I'm thinking about weaponizing the face is turning the face into an antagonistic force. And we've seen this in the past with the Zapatistas. You have Subcomandante Marcos on the right. Right in the Zapatistas say they hide their faces so that they may be seen. You have the black bloc tactic in the middle, and then you have the Algerian freedom fighters in the 1966 film The Battle of Algiers, who kind of dress in this Western terrorist drag and wear their oppressors' faces so that they can break into occupied territory. So all of this leads me to the question, what would specifically be this queer politics of escape, queer politics of the non-recognizable, of becoming imperceptible? And you can think about this over simple things like gay marriage, right, where you would have a more radical queer contingent that is completely anti-gay marriage because they do not want to seek representational legitimation through the state. And you can also see this with Occupy, right, and the no demands, right, not having any demands because there are no demands to be made to that form of representational power. So basically, I've decided to make this facial weaponization suite, which is basically developing sets of tools that allow you to turn your face into a weapon and try and evade things like biometric detection. And the first thing that I decided to do with this was to make masks. And basically, I was thinking about two possible options. One is this idea of collective masks, of trying to wear the faces of many simultaneously. And then the other was impossible expressions, which this is the artist Arthur Elsinore, who's kind of experimented this with this in a different way by attaching electrodes to his face. So I decided to go with a collective fag face mask. And basically the first test was gathering images of notable gay men and then prepping their faces to be worked with in 3D modeling software. Then I used Rhino. And these faces were basically brought together, and just like biometrics work through through plotting landmarks, basically all these were gathered not into an average, but brought together in the bottom left-hand corner, which basically produces a kind of like alien-looking, unrecognizable result. But this is why it's rough, because this is a little too alien ape for me right now. But the point is that by wearing the faces of many simultaneously, you get something unrecognizable. And the masks are really important because they have a large history within queerness and feminism. You have like Latina feminist Gloria Anzaldúa talking about making faces. And clearly masks today are something that causes power to be a little apprehensive, right? Because when everyone was wearing anonymous masks when Occupy Wall Street started in New York, the New York City Police Department resurrected an old law from the 1800s forbidding more than two people to wear masks in public unless it was you were at a masquerade. So basically, this is the mask right now, and I'll play you this.
The suite also provides sets of masks. Our collective masks allow you to wear the faces of many with a single mask. generated from numerous faces. You can select a range of face types most commonly targeted by facial recognition technologies, such as the terrorist, illegal immigrant, criminal, and homosexual. In the tradition of collective protest actions that evade individual recognition, like the Black Bloc, our collective masks offer a mutated alien face that cannot be read or parsed. While facial detection claims that a homosexual or terrorist can be recognized, simultaneously wearing the faces of many homosexuals or many terrorists confuses the apparatus because your face is no longer recognizable to it. The suite includes...
Okay, and so the idea at the end is basically to do public interventions with these masks in sites where facial recognition has been highly contested. Okay, that's it. Thanks.
Hi. Okay. Thank you, Zach. Pinar Yoldas is our next speaker. Pinar Yoldas is a cross-disciplinary artist. She needs sound. Pinar Yoldas is a cross-disciplinary artist, all-in-one designer, neuro-enthusiast. Pinar has a bachelor's degree in architecture from METU, master's of science from ITU, master of arts from Istanbul Bilgi University, and a master of fine arts from UCLA. She's currently pursuing her PhD at Duke University. Her research interests include speculative biology, evolutionary aesthetics, art neuroscience interactions, and subversive gaming environments. In today's session, she'll talk about her perverted interest in sites of detritus and their potential to generate new species of excess.
Thank you, Micah. Hello, everyone. Thanks for coming to our panel of all the 5,000 plus panels happening at 3:30. Before I jump right in, I'd like to thank Genita Plus, a non-existing biotechnology startup specializing in custom sex organs. Without their generous support, I wouldn't be here now. Today I'm going to talk about my current project, Speculative Biologies. I'll talk about waste and genitalia. To begin with, I'll show you some sad imagery and bring our collective mood down a little bit. The first site that I want to talk about is a city called İzmit in Turkey. On August 1999, a 7.6 magnitude earthquake hit the northwestern part of Turkey, killing 35,000 people and leaving 500,000 people homeless, including my uncle and his family. And this earthquake was the largest event on record to have devastated such an industrialized modern area since the 1906 Tokyo and 1923 San Francisco earthquakes. And I went there. Yet my trip to İzmit wasn't to support my relatives. It was an architectural trip. I was a junior in architecture school, and my department decided to take my class to the epicenter of the earthquake. The earthquake had demolished the entire city, and part of the problem was defective building codes. Apparently, young architects had a lesson to learn. So although it was 40 days after the earthquake when I got there, I have a vivid sense memory of rotting flesh mixed with dust in the air. It was a rupture in time, rupture in physicality, rupture in what Turkey was back then. But for me, it was the first time I was actually surrounded by broken objects, raised walls, at an urban scale. So in İzmit, civilization was ripped off from its context and stripped down to its bare material reality. The image of İzmit earthquake marked the beginning of my interest in sites of detritus, waste, and trash. And the problem, in, well, part of the problem in Izmit was, let me give you a historical context. Turkey was not a historical player in the Industrial Revolution. However, in cities like Izmit, industrialization did occur at a sickening pace, forcing the city to expand into earthquake zones. And the demolition of the city by an alien force coming from the depths of the planet made a connection between industrialism and consumerism and waste kind of clear in my head. The second site of excess I want to talk about is the shopping mall. Again, when I was in architecture school, I started to work on a shopping mall project, a mall designed to be the biggest one in Turkey. As an architectural intern, I did months of research on Western examples of shopping malls, and I paid many, many site visits to this particular shopping mall. But every time I passed by this shopping mall, I couldn't help but think of the post-earthquake version of it. Broken shop windows, ruptured mannequins, canned food bent and exploded like industrial vomit in my face. I started to see this concrete and steel manifestation of capitalism in its future version, as if I was wearing some post-apocalyptic glasses. And I kept thinking about an imaginary or theoretical site where physical junk met with cultural junk. Apparently, the way junk happens has a lot to do with our consumption habits, and those habits are shaped by a culture based on instant gratification and short-term convenience. As overconsumption spread to the world like an Ebola virus, this like imaginary side of detritus grew larger and larger in my head until one day I found out about the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. So have you heard of Great Pacific? Yeah, good. Also known as Pacific Trash Vortex, this is a floating nexus of marine litter in the central North Pacific Ocean, formed gradually as a result of marine pollution gathered by oceanic currents. Although its borders are hard to determine due to its dynamic nature, it's estimated to be around 2,200 kilometers long and 800 kilometers wide, about the size of the state or twice the size of Texas. What Pacific Trash Vortex is actually the global result of global consumption and global culture. It's an international monument of mindless consumption. It is international in that every country bordering the Pacific contribute to it, even if they don't want to. So this is imagery by Chris Jordan, a photographer who captures this exact moment of the fusion of bone, marrow, and feather with bottle caps, energy drinks, car parts. This is, you know, the animals around us, like, or the ecology is affected because due to photodegradation, smaller and smaller particles of plastic is generated and the food chain is contaminated. So, you know, I was thinking about this. I'm going to show you a short video I made. The discoverer of Pacific Trash Vortex is Captain Richard Moore, and this is him talking about the vortex while holding, like, a sample. And I just zoomed into the sample. Oops, is it?
The ocean has become a plastic soup. This is the soup.
Yeah, he says, I don't know if you could hear it, he says the ocean has turned into a plastic soup. So I was thinking about this, like the soup, and let's remember the primordial soup theory. Millions of years ago, life started in Earth's prebiotic oceans, where the first molecules of life had formed. And I was thinking, could nanomolecules of plastic be the next building blocks of life? So, or to put it another way, if life started today in a techno-capitalist primordial soup, what kind of life forms would emerge? So here's my answer. I started designing species of excess emerging from this contemporary primordial soup. Here you can see the plastic eggs hatching. These species are inspired by the ways consumerism targets our bodies, such as the digestive system. And this one, I designed this like Klein bottle-like digestive system as an infinite surface of mastication, ingestion, digestion, and defecation. So you're basically eating your own poo. I also designed orgies of tumors and neoplastic bodies. And let's see. And I decided to study them. So I started to design the life support systems to study these species further. Here are some examples. And this one, this series is called Urogenital Folds. It was an attempt to grow fallow feminine genitalia based on this fact. Until the 12th week of pregnancy, all human fetus or feti, I mean plural fetus, have what could be called female genitalia. So like having found out about that, I was like, oh, what if, you know, we mixed the two or that transformation never happens. So following that, I focused on reproductive system as the next biological system on my speculative biology to-do list. I focused on the idea of biological and cultural reproduction in a capitalistic society, and I started to design new sexual organs, such as new labia, new glands, new penises, new vagina, new breasts, etc. Both digestive and reproductive systems have a lot to do with pain and pleasure. To orchestrate sensation or even to intensify it, one must study pain and pleasure. And here you can see Paul Ekman. He's a neuroscientist who specializes on the study of emotions based on facial expressions. Here you can see his model of emotions juxtaposed on Spinozan model of emotions, which is basically pain, pleasure, and desire. This is a cross-section of the nerve endings in the skin. Pain and pleasure starts with touch. Our bodies are equipped with a multitude of cutaneous receptors or touch receptors. In this cross-section, the arrows point at like the nerve fibers that perceive pain. So the question I asked was, can we play with sensation to make hypersexual creatures? Or if art is orchestrating sensation, why not play with it at the cellular level? And oddly enough, as I mentioned, there are pain receptors on the skin, but there is no one single dedicated pleasure receptor. Pleasure is a complex sensation. So in my project, I canceled out pain receptors and multiplied the number of all the other touch receptors to increase the density of receptors per square millimeter of skin in order to get more pleasure by less stimulus. So the big question here is, technology redefines nature, can new tissues redefine humanity? And ladies and gentlemen, meet Super Mammal. This is a cluster of mammary glands repeated excessively. And in this project, I focused on mammary glands, again, you know, tissue specific to skin. And I multiplied it many times. And breast is a highly charged organ. It means nutrition or survival for the baby. It means pleasure for adults. And by endlessly repeating this organ, can we actually increase the pleasure factor, or do we totally kill it? When I came up with this idea, I was really like excited. I was like, oh, super mammal, a lot of breasts, awesome, etc. And I thought I was the first person to think about this. But of course, this is from 1st century AD, the Artemis of Ephesus. I wasn't the first one to think about multiplied breasts. My ancestors from Anatolia, Aegean, had already like came up with this idea. This is the next species I want to talk about, mega male. It's a linear arrangement of penises. This species has a limited repertoire of behavior, which only consists of erection and ejaculation. Here's a detail. And the last one I want to talk about is the lovely, beautiful neolabium, an enhanced female reproductive organ. On top of labia minora and majora, there is labia synthetica. And in this specific organ, the nerve endings and blood vessels are increased to make this new organ extra sensitive to any kind of stimulant. Here is like the kind of, I would call it the gestation state of neolabium. They're like tiny little vaginas growing, and then they'll be like taken into different containers for further modification, some more images. And this is the monster neolabium with like the tentacles coming out. And some more images. And some more species from the same series that I'm not going to talk about here now. A snapshot of the installation. And before I end my talk, I'll show you a quick 2-minute video, maybe 1 minute, of speculative biologies. Yeah, great. After the rain and everything else, now I can't view my video. I think I'll have to just play it like this because I don't know what happens when I go to full screen. Sorry about that.
Synthetic biology is the design of biological systems not found in nature. Speculative biology is an artistic take on synthetic biology. All art modifies and orchestrates the human sensorium. Art plays with sensations. Can we generate new sensations by designing new organs, new biological systems? Can we engineer the human body to multiply, intensify, and purify pleasure? Speculative biology's project proposes new tissues, new organs, and new bodies. These deviant anatomies emerge from Marcus' human needs. Organogenesis, excessive repetition of genitalia, produce purely sexual species. Penis, glands, vagina, vulva, labia are redefined to open up new hedonic possibilities. The site of pleasure, the skin is re-engineered. The nerve endings and blood vessels are multiplied in number. The surface area of labia is increased. A new femininity and masculinity is born.
All right, we don't need to see the credits because it's all done by me. And... All right, to get more info about the project, you can go to my website, and this is all my, most of my online presence. Thank you so much for listening.
Yes. Okay, so thank you all for coming. Thank you for staying. I know time's up, but we started a few minutes late. Can we do a few minutes of questions? Sure.
If there are any questions, of course.
Don't be shy. That was all perfectly clear. Yes. Oh, we have a mic for you.
Thank you so much for that incredible presentation. I had a question to you actually about the posters that ended up staying up for a year. And I wonder what people actually ended up reading the line about the penitentiary, because think that the human brain, once it registers a warning once in one iteration, sort of assumes that it knows all other iterations of it, the same way that you might, at a pool, for example, it'll say, like, slow down on the side when you're a kid, and maybe you read it the first time, but after that you just keep running because nothing happened after. Right. And so thinking about the far-reaching effects of, like, being warned don't quite register, and our brain just sort of skips it over. And so I wonder, is there a benefit to not drawing new attention to an item like that that ends up being something that people skip over?
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I think part of the idea was there was to do this alternate reality performance that is, like, you know, kind of enmeshed in everyday life, so that there's, like, a potential slippage where you might see it and you might not. But I think we're all interested in different kinds of imperceptibility and invisible performance, or performances that you might not know are a performance. Any other questions? Okay, I guess we're done. Thank you.